The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, this is Guardian Daily for Wednesday, the 3rd of September. I'm Claire Catford. On the way, stamp duty axed on homes below £175,000. But is this an empty gesture from a government in crisis?
The stamp duty holiday is a complete dud. It was tried before by the John Major government in the early 1990s and failed abysmally then. And it will fail abysmally this time too.
Normal service resumes as the Republicans get stuck into their convention. We have the latest from St. Paul in Minnesota. Plus, the new cocoon that's our cue to watch scientists at work at London's Natural History Museum.
Something that we're very keen to do is to metaphorically throw open the doors so that people can see what historically has been going on behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum.
But first, a summary of today's news and a quick flick through the papers.
President Bush has made a strong speech in favour of the Republican candidate to replace him. On a video link from the White House, he told the party convention in Minnesota that John McCain was an independent man who thinks for himself. He had disagreed with the president, but had also been a man who could support the successful troop surge in Iraq. Today, the vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, makes her speech to the convention. We'll have a full report later in Guardian Daily. Thailand is under a state of emergency as anti-government protests built up in the capital, Bangkok. The protesters clashed with pro-government supporters and then had to be separated by riot police. We'll hear shortly direct from the city. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee meets today to decide on interest rates. Yesterday, the government announced new measures to try to boost the housing market, but the OECD reported that it expected Britain would be the only one of the seven leading economies to go into recession. Valium, the tranquilizer that used to be widespread among housewives in the 60s, is once again back in popularity, but this time among drug users. The charity DrugScope says there is now a heroin shortage, and so junkies are turning to Valium, or diazepam, which is its correct medical name. It's still not clear if Kevin Keegan has resigned as manager of Newcastle Football Club. The club said last night that it had not sacked him, but that it was negotiating over long-term strategy. Keegan is apparently angry because he is not in charge of player transfers. Last night, fans supporting him gathered outside St James's Park. And his story dominates the back pages of the papers. The Mirror says fans accuse the club owner of forcing him to quit. The Mail says that Keegan is doomed as he consults his lawyers. The Sun says that the owners try to sell star striker Michael Owen. The Guardian, Telegraph and Financial Times all lead on the economy, saying that they don't expect Gordon Brown's plans for the housing market to have much effect and that his launch was undermined by the international report predicting recession for the country. All the papers carry the story of the CCTV pictures of the millionaire businessman whose house was burnt down in Shropshire. They show him carrying a gun around the grounds. And The Guardian puts vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin on its front page, reporting that she used to be a supporter of a party that wants her state, Alaska, to break away from the USA. There's more news and views throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Home buyers will be off the hook from today as the current stamp duty threshold is raised from £125,000 to £175,000. The move will last for 12 months and is being seen as a way to kick-start the housing market. It comes after the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, told The Guardian that the country was facing its worst economic crisis in 60 years. The Liberal Democrats said the plan was just part of a hodgepodge of measures to save Gordon Brown's skin. I asked Larry Elliott, The Guardian's economics editor, whether this was fair.
Well, I think it's a bit of a curate's egg. There are bits of it which I think are good. I think the shared equity scheme is a sensible move to stop people from having their homes repossessed. It's not going to be that many people, but I think any people who the government keeps with a roof over their head is a good thing. I think the stamp duty holiday is a complete dud. It was tried before by the John Major government in the early 1990s and failed abysmally then. And it will fail abysmally this time too, because what we're seeing here is the collapse of an almighty housing bubble. And having a 12-month stamp duty holiday for homes below £175,000 is not going to have one iota of difference, I wouldn't have thought, to that process, which is going to unwind in its own way. I mean, if you think about it, The maximum amount you would save as a first-time buyer is £1,750 on a house worth £175,000. But prices fell alone by £3,000 last month, according to the Nationwide Building Society. So you'd have to be kind of nuts to go out there and buy a house just because you're saving £1,750. I think it will have negligible impact on the housing market. And in fact, lower house prices are probably, in the long run, necessary and a good thing. And although it's painful for those people who are going to be in negative equity, I think in the long term, the health of the British economy and the housing market requires that process to continue. And what the government has done will not stop that process from happening.
Is the government, do you think, going to be able to dig itself out of what is certainly a crisis in terms of the reaction to the news and the interview that Alice Darling gave The Guardian at the weekend, that we're in the worst crisis in 60 years, and of course the continued stress that the whole world is facing in terms of the economic situation?
Well, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to do. I'm not really sure that the government has got the tools at its disposal to get us out of the mess it's in. I don't think Darling actually thinks that the economy, the UK economy, is in the worst state it's been for 60 years. I think what he was really talking about was that the combination of the credit crunch and rising commodity prices had created global conditions which were as challenging as any that we've seen since the Second World War. I don't think he was specifically talking about the UK economy. But there's no doubt that the UK economy is going to have two very tough years. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris said today that the UK was going to have two quarters of recession in the second half of 2008. And I think that's just the latest of a long run of forecasters who've spotted that the UK is in serious trouble. Now, you know, there are only a limited number of things the government could do. It could cut interest rates, but it doesn't actually control interest rates. They're controlled by the Bank of England. And there are people on the Monetary Policy Committee who want interest rates to be cut, but I think they'll probably be held 5% this week. And it can use tax and spending policy or fiscal policy. I mean, it's done a bit of that, but actually the public finances are in quite a state. I mean, that's why this package today was actually fairly small beer. I mean, you're only talking about £1 billion in a government spending total per year of in excess of £500 billion. So you're talking actually quite small amounts of money, but it's all the government can afford given its dire financial position.
And it's intriguing as well because David Cameron has appeared to backpedal a bit. I mean, he's been saying that he would not necessarily be able to cut taxes, there'd be huge financial demands if there was a Conservative government. And even though he's very upfront about criticising Labour and says that this is to some extent a short-term survival plan to keep Mr Brown in a job, it's interesting to see that he's becoming more cautious in what he's saying as well.
Yeah, well, I think up to a point he's right about it being a short-term survival plan. And I think this is a much more a political package than it is an economic package. And it's designed primarily to see the Prime Minister through what looks like a pretty testing couple of months in terms of keeping his job. I mean, I think this will probably give him the breathing space to get through the Labour Party conference and perhaps through the pre-budget report in the month after that. But by the end of the year, if we're not seeing any revival in the housing market, and I don't think we will be seeing one, then we will start to have the question marks about Brown revived again, I think.
Economics editor Larry Elliott. And for more analysis, fact sheets, and to have your say on the changes, find that at guardian.co.uk/money. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, England versus South Africa. Follow the final one day alive with our over-by-over reports. That's at guardian.co.uk/sport. To have a situation where the wife's status is uncertain is un-Islamic. Riazat Butt investigates a proposal for Muslim marriage contracts. That's at guardian.co.uk/audio. And, well, 007, your chance to quiz Daniel Craig. That's at filmguardian.co.uk/blogs.
As you gather tonight in St. Paul, I want to share some thoughts about our nominee, a great American and the next president of the United States, John McCain.
I'm Richard Adams outside the Excel Centre in St. Paul, where the first day of the Republican convention has finally got underway. It now, as of tonight, it starts to feel like a real convention again. You've got a hall full of the chairing delegates and speeches are being given, compared to yesterday when the whole city felt a bit dead. It still feels a little bit like the whole convention's got off on the wrong foot. like this is not really a proper start, but I think things will heat up again a bit more tomorrow.
If you want to know who John McCain is, if you want to know what John McCain values, look at the men and women who wear America's uniform today. This is the kind of character that civilizations from the beginning of our history have sought in their leaders.
And a strong executive and proven reformer, Governor Sarah Palin. I'm proud that America's first female vice president will be a Republican woman.
The speakers ranged from the two Bushes, Laura Bush in person and George Bush via video satellite link. There was Fred Thompson, the former presidential candidate, and there was Joe Lieberman, the former Democratic senator from Connecticut.
I'm here to support John McCain because country matters more than party.
They had two consistent messages. One was that Sarah Palin was a very good choice for the vice president. The other one was that John McCain served in the military and was a prisoner of war and has suffered for his country and was an even better choice to be president.
Senator Barack Obama is a gifted and eloquent young man who I think can do great things for our country in the years ahead. But my friends, eloquence is no substitute for a record. Not in these tough times for America.
The attacks on the Democrats and Obama in particular were understated. They were more concerned with making a contrast in terms of putting America first, the implication being that Republicans put America first and Democrats don't. Fred Thompson described John McCain as, "We don't need to ask, who is this man?" The implication being that Barack Obama is exotic and unknown.
Now, speaking of the vice presidential nominee, what a breath of fresh air Governor Sarah Palin is.
Sarah Palin was announced only last Friday as John McCain's vice president, and in the 4 or 5 days since that has passed, a number of fascinating stories about Mrs. Palin's past have started to emerge. I mean, there was the case of her 17-year-old daughter was pregnant, was one in particular, but a number of other things, such as her attempt to ban books from libraries, her interest in teaching creationism in schools in Alaska, and a number of other things. And this is only after 4 days. I mean, another week, who knows what will come out.
John will have an outstanding leader at his side. America will have a strong and principled vice president in the governor of the great state of Alaska, Sarah Palin.
Well, tomorrow is Sarah Palin's big day in that she gets to speak to a national audience. There'll be a lot of interest in her speech. And given the way that she's being portrayed as inexperienced and young, in fact, the expectations for her will be very low. So as long as she doesn't fall over on the way to the platform, she'll probably be fine. My guess is that she'll talk about her family, the time that she's been governor of Alaska, and she'll try and present herself as a sort of modern and fresh. She may even talk about her history-breaking role in being the first Republican vice presidential nominee who is a woman. But I think she'd be more interested in doing what she's done since she was named, which is energizing the conservative base. So it'd be very interesting to look at her speech and see what sort of messages she's trying to put out and who she's trying to reach. I think that'll be interesting. I'd be very surprised if she was trying to actually win Democrats over. I mean, I don't think there's any possibility of that. But it'd be interesting to see how she tries to pitch herself at independents and former Republican voters.
And for more analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/US elections 2008. I'm Claire Catford. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, Prime Minister Samak Zundrava declares a state of emergency in Bangkok after the worst violence for over 15 years.
By declaring the state of emergency, he rather hoped that the army might step in to clear these protesters away because they've ignored everything else. So he's in a very difficult position.
The British Film Institute celebrates 75 years of groundbreaking film history. So what are the nation's top choices?
We're 75 years old, that's really, really young. We've only just started. And as we were founded to get that debate and that national conversation going about film, we thought, well, hang on, you know, let's reignite the conversation.
But first, a metamorphosis has been making news at London's Natural History Museum. An 8-storey high cocoon has been unveiled. It'll be the new home for the museum's 20 million plant and insect specimens. It'll also allow us to watch scientists at work. The structure is being called the most significant development at the museum since it moved to its current site in 1881. It's all part of the latest phase of the £78 million Darwin Centre and is set to open in 2009. We've been speaking to the museum's director, Dr. Michael Dixon, in one of the new labs.
We're standing now in a science lab space, but we're looking through two panes of glass at the wonderful atrium space with the 8-storey high, 65-metre-long cocoon. What is of interest here is you can see two of the windows from the cocoon from which our visitors will be able to see from the public exhibition space actually into science labs and see what's going on within those spaces. Something that we're very keen to do is to metaphorically throw open the doors so that people can see what historically has been going on behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum.
One of the key things is the public involvement. How important is it to get the message across and get people involved?
It's very important. We regard it as a publicly funded institution as our role to contribute to increasing levels of scientific literacy. We have a very strong secondary science program here where demonstrably we're affecting young people's career choice. You will be aware, of course, that there is a shortage of scientists being trained in this country and the potential problems that that will create for our economy if it's not addressed. And we see it as a fundamental part of our role to inspire young people to consider science as a career, to see scientists in this institution, see them as role models, see them as not the kind of stereotypes that sometimes scientists are portrayed as in the media.
What do you make of science coverage in the media at the moment?
I think two things. One is historically, perhaps, there is a difficulty in making science accessible to general readers. And I think the skills that people develop in communicating complex science ideas to lay people is something that we're developing a great deal of expertise at here at the museum, and that can only be for the good. I think the other thing to say is that there is a burgeoning public interest in scientific issues, particularly around things like climate change and the impact of climate change on the natural world. So I think these two positive things should come together, and I hope over time we'll see higher standards of presentation of science in all forms of the media.
With a building like this, there's some element of pressure in order to get the public through your doors. Are you worried at all about that?
Well, we're finding in recent years, since we went free again in December 2001, that our numbers are still rising. Last year we had 3.8 million visits to the museum, so more than doubled, about 2.5 times what we had previously. We fully anticipate that when the Darwin Centre opens to the public that we'll go through 4 million visits for the first time. Partly I think that's driven by public interest in environmental issues. I hope and trust as well that Darwin Centre will prove to be so attractive, both as a building and an architectural spectacle, but also the ways that we present what the museum does, that we'll see ever-increasing numbers of people visiting the museum.
Dr. Michael Dixon, Director of the Natural History Museum, speaking to Andy Duckworth. And on Monday, download the Science Weekly podcast for a tour around the new building, and that'll be at guardian.co.uk/science.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
A state of emergency has been declared in Thailand after increasingly violent anti-government protests left one person dead and 34 injured. Ian McKinnon's in Bangkok. He told Guardian Daily's John Dennis why the demonstrators are demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Samak Sundarrajah.
They have said that he is just a proxy for Thaksin Shinawat. It was these people, the People's Alliance for Democracy, who held months and months of protests during 2006, which eventually led to the coup, to the army taking to the streets. These people, the PAD, are a collection of right-wing activists and businessmen who mainly hail from Bangkok. They're part of the urban elite. They hold up the king of Thailand as very much their emblem. So they saw Thaksin and by extension the election of Samak, by mainly the rural poor as something that they really vehemently disagree with. And partly they would like to get rid of him because of his closeness to Thaksin and because they say he is corrupt himself.
What's the atmosphere like now in Bangkok?
Actually, surprisingly, it's quite calm. I've been to the point where the demonstrators have been gathering today. And there's rather still a carnival atmosphere within the compound. There's food stalls and people are out under awnings listening to speeches and so on, though at barricades of tires and razor wire around the place, they were handing out golf clubs, hundreds of golf clubs, which they've been using or plan to use to protect themselves in the event, I guess, of the rival demonstrators coming again. Those are pro-government demonstrators, or indeed the army trying to come to clear them from the compound.
Why has the Prime Minister deemed it necessary to declare a state of emergency?
Well, this is quite a dramatic escalation of the violence. There had been some trouble around this fairly long-running anti-government protest, but with the death of one man and 43 others injured, three of them from gunshot wounds, that is quite a dramatic upturn in the level of violence.
Protesters are calling for the resignation of Samak as Prime Minister. Will he step down?
Well, he's resolutely said up until now that he wouldn't step down. So he has set out a stall, and by declaring the state of emergency, I think he rather hoped that the army might step in to clear these protesters away because they've ignored everything else. There were arrest warrants out for the leaders of the anti-government demonstrators, but that has had no effect so far. So he's in a very difficult position. And indeed, the army chief said not long after Samak announced the state of emergency that he himself didn't plan to use force to break up these anti-government demonstrations.
Well, the view of the military is crucial, isn't it? Because until earlier this year, it was a military government in Thailand.
Well, indeed, but Samak and his six-party coalition were elected in last December's election. So the army, after the coup of 2006, had appointed a government which then decided on elections, which Samak won. The problem for the army and the government that it appointed then was that Samak was very closely allied to Thaksin Shinawat, who was deposed by the coup in 2006.
And meanwhile, the election commission in Thailand has called for the Prime Minister's party to be dissolved.
This is a dispute that's been running for quite some time, and indeed, it's still unclear how it might play out. What has happened is the election commission has recommended that the constitutional court disband the party for electoral fraud, for vote buying, but the attorney general has to take a decision whether this decision should then go to the constitutional court, and then the constitutional court, of course, is open to make its own decision. That's something that could take months and months.
And there's more on the situation in Thailand at guardian.co.uk/world.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now, it's 75 years old this month and determined to get the nation talking about film. Formed in 1933, the British Film Institute set itself the grand task of encouraging the use of the cinematograph as a means of entertainment and instruction. Well, fast forward to 2008, and the Institute pledges to show films that provoke emotion and debate. I asked the BFI's director, Amanda Neville, whether the Institute had the same priorities as it did 75 years ago.
Well, I think almost certainly we'd probably express it in slightly more modern language, but the spirit and the intention that underlies that statement is absolutely the same, which is, you know, we're on a mission to ensure that everyone, no matter where they live, can have access to the broadest diversity of cinema and recognise, or moving image really nowadays, because obviously we take in television and we take in, you know, digitally created materials. But I think actually further down in that wonderful piece of paper which sets out why the BFI was founded, it also recognised, I thought this was so clever and it had such a great degree of foresight, that film was both, you know, fantastic fantastic artistic form in its own right. It was a wonderful form of entertainment, but that also it was a brilliant communication medium, you know, to better help us understand who we are and who other people are and different views and worlds and cultures and things.
And of course the film that we may have seen in 1933 is very different to the film that we see now. We almost take film and movies for granted. But it was a huge shock to the system in 1933. I know that film was invented before that, but it was a very different environment, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think there's interesting things, and it's, you know, some of the things that I've observed and learnt through the privilege of being at the BFI. I mean, the BFI was formed, I think, 38 years after film was born. And I suppose the one big difference is that there was still huge anxiety about film. It was, you know, viewed as frivolous and something which didn't necessarily ennoble, and something which somebody talked about brought wool with glitter to youth. So, you know, a lot of people were quite disparaging and anxious about it as a medium. And I think by and large we've moved beyond that now. I think we've moved to a stage where we all know that the power of film today is really helpful rather than destructive.
You have asked a whole lot of celebrities and well-known film buffs for their favourite films as part of your Visions for the Future, which is part of the birthday celebrations. What do they come up with? There's a whole host of different people. The most surprising ones that you discovered.
Yeah, it was a fantastic project. I mean, really what we're saying is, you know, we're 75 years old, that's really, really young. We've only just started. And as we were founded to get that debate and that national conversation going about film, we thought, well, hang on, you know, let's reignite the conversation. So what we're doing is we're actually inviting everybody across the country to think about what is the one film that you would want to share with future generations. And there's some really fabulous things that you can already deduce just from those first 75. I mean, number one is British film really precipitates and comes to the top. So, you know, huge references to David Lean and Michael Powell. And there's also a lot of reference to, quite a good reference to, you know, contemporary filmmakers. So Shane Meadows is in there, for example.
I like Matt Lucas's choice, Billy Elliot.
Yes.
That's quite interesting. Greg Dyke chooses Cabaret, and Lord Putnam chooses Local Hero.
Yes.
But as you say, it's very mixed. Your favourite film, I have to ask?
Well, my favourite film at that moment, and I have to say every day, you know, I think, oh, would I choose another one today? But I chose A Diary for Timothy by Humphrey Jennings. And Humphrey Jennings was the most wonderful, wonderful documentary maker when documentary filmmaking was, I think, at its zenith just round about the Second World War and just after. And the film, not only does it in the most wonderful way give you a feeling of what it was like to live around about 1945, it predicts what the future will be like for this little baby.
For more on film, including the latest news, reviews and listings, go to guardian.co.uk/film. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Peter Sale and Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Catford. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.